Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. So, how do we get from, how do we get from Talmadge, Woodstow, Roberts, Eyring, and others all supporting, you know, science and evolution? How do we go from there to the, you know, the publishing of Man's Origin and Destiny, then the publishing of Mormon Doctrine, then the sort of infiltration of these ideas into the CES system to the point where I received sort of the anti-scientist teachings in the 1980s? Like, how did so many scientists lose and Joseph Fielding Smith win? Do you have, in terms of
battle? I can answer that in two words: Mormon Doctrine, because that sold so many copies and was viewed as by so many LDS people as being the authoritative statement. Even now you read his comments in there. If you didn't know better, you would think very clearly that this was that the church condemned the theory of evolution.
But I'll add to that something that I think I picked up from the article I cited previously, and that's that Roberts, Woodstow, and Talmadge all died, like, in the, 30s, 40s, or 50s. And Joseph Fielding Smith went on to live for two or three or four decades more. Like, is that also a fair explanation for how this happened?
Well, but again, remember that I don't think that Elder Smith's book was nearly as influential as Elder McConkie's.
Yeah, and in
so
you...
I think if it had only been Elder Smith's book, it probably wouldn't have been nearly as much of an issue.
And it sounds like you grew up in more of an era where McConkie's book hadn't really taken hold in the mass culture like it had by the time I was growing up. And Joseph Fielding Smith's book just hadn't made a dent in the consciousness writ large. Is that fair to say?
I think that maybe I would just say what was different about my growing up is that I grew up with an environment with LDS scientists all around me.
Right.
At BYU. And so they knew what the facts were and how all this worked out. And I never really saw this more widespread view and the more widespread acceptance of Mormon doctrine until I was like on my mission.
Right.
So I think it was what was different is the environment I grew up was not the standard LDS environment.
Okay. So here's sort of a pause in our historical recounting, and this is me just asking you a non-scientific, heart-based, emotional question. It's probably not fair to do to a scientist, but I'm going to do it anyway. I guess I'm trying to be a scientist now as I study clinical psychology and getting a PhD, so I can't say I'm not a scientist, but, you know, historically I haven't affiliated as a scientist or sort of self-described myself as a scientist. But even as someone who hasn't characterized themselves as a scientist up until now, when I read this history of how science sort of got the bad end of the deal at the hand of first Joseph Fielding Smith, but then larger Bruce R. McConkie, and how it led to the environment that I experienced at BYU, I feel not only sad for B.H. Roberts and Talmadge and Woodstow and Eyring in this regard, but I feel a little bit angry and resentful at how prominent Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie's personal views and biases became within the broader Mormon culture. Like, I feel there's a part of me that feels like they did serious damage to our credibility worldwide and to, you know, the reputation of scientists for literally generations. So there's a part of me that's enraged about this. And in all of the writings that I've seen from you and in our conversation so far, I don't feel any of that. So I'm wondering, like, do you just not see things the way I do? Or did you have that anger or frustration at one point and you've processed it? Or, you know, or am I just reading things wrong and there's really no room for frustration or outrage?
Yes, I think what we have to consider here, I mean, a lot of people talk about the influence of Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie. Like I say, as I've already said, I certainly think Bruce R. McConkie had a lot more influence with his Mormon Doctrine book. But I think we have to keep in mind, though, that they weren't writing in a vacuum. I think that, in general, many LDS people really did still prefer a rather literalist, fundamentalist view of the scriptures. And I would say the majority of the church was quite receptive to what they had written and were very, very supportive of those views. And so I'm not really comfortable casting blame. I just think it's just sort of like a lot of these discussions about some of the earlier, say, racist views that were sort of somewhat more prominent in the church in earlier years, and which we even see in some comments by some of the general authorities. But again, this was just the milieu that they were in. Those types of comments and views were quite common at the time, and I think exactly the same is really true about evolution. Again, keep in mind, to this day, here we are in the 21st century, 44% of the American public believes that the Earth was created at one time in the last 10,000 years, according to a recent poll. So even now, and I think from what I can see, the views of the church members are not too much different than that. So the McConkie and Elder Smith were really just saying things that people wanted to believe anyway.
Yeah, and that's cool. I mean, context is always super important, and I tend to fall into this trap that many of us do, you know, of judging historical figures harshly without considering the context. And it sounds like you understand that context better, and that context has led you to not feel as angry with those writings. And you're almost kind of saying that it's what the people wanted. They wanted a less nuanced, a less sophisticated, a less intellectual and scientific worldview, and they wanted a more simplistic, orthodox, fundamentalist view. Is that fair in my recharacterization of what you said people wanted?
That's exactly right. And as I mentioned, I would further add that's what they want to the present day.
So does that just mean that most people are kind of simpletons or ostriches with their head in the sand, or just they've got a lot of problems so they want to keep it simple? I mean, what does that mean for your sort of view of general human nature and the general membership of the church? It probably sounds mean to say, but there's a part of me that just, we have this milk and meat, and somehow meat is greater than milk, and the glory of God is intelligence. And you could go back to the founding documents of Joseph Smith, and there's just this strong call for searching for truth and knowledge and understanding. And that's sort of the bold, courageous Mormonism that, you know, many of us love and fell in love with. And a lot of people today are maybe frustrated with the correlation and with the ways that church curriculum has been simplified and sort of watered down, and how we're not as willing to jump into the fray. And so I guess I understand it. I don't want to sound arrogant that intellectualism is better, because I definitely don't believe that that's necessarily true. And I probably agree with the brethren that from a religious standpoint, none of this matters to one's eternal salvation. But is there a part of you that's a little bit sad that that's kind of the way people lean?
Oh, generally? Very much so. Very sad, I think, because I guess my sadness is the following, because I know that if that is the general tenor of what LDS youth in particular are led to believe, that that's really going to set up a crisis of faith among them. I mean, that's really the source of my sadness, is that by not being a little bit more candid and open about what the real facts are of modern science and what is tenable and what is not, that many youth are being set up for a crisis of faith when they go off to college or even at places like BYU and suddenly discover that this rather simple world that they believed no longer can be defended. Then, and particularly if they are taught to believe that one must choose, but there is this war between science and religion, and one must choose one side or the other, then that to me is a real problem, because for many of them, they will make a choice and they will choose to disassociate with the church, and that's just not really necessary. As to how do you really assess the blame? I don't really know. In fact, I would place part of the blame on the scientific community, not only within the church, but in the general society. I think that scientists have done a rather poor job of communicating the facts and the excitement of modern science to the public. And we also have the serious education problem, wherein science in general and is just not sort of avoided if you can when you're going through school. But I would definitely put part of the blame on scientists themselves.
Right, right. And I imagine that you have strong feelings about Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and some of those scientists who as well, who have sort of, you know, taken a full frontal shot at religion, in addition to the believing scientists who maybe haven't been effective communicators.
Oh, the Hitchens and Dawkins, they're public relations nightmares for those of us who would like to see serious, no-nonsense science taught in public schools. It's just most unfortunate that they chose to express their views the way they did, particularly since, from a theological point of view, they're really rather naive. And they put up for as exemplary of modern religion only a rather fundamentalist core. And so it's, you know, many even some scientists who are not particularly religious have come out and really expressed concern at the writings of some of these that are just sort of bending over backwards to express their atheism.
Okay, so what you've been saying so far really resonates with me on a level. Like, you know, I was set up for the type of disillusionment that you describe, because I was, you know, my parents weren't scientifically minded necessarily. You know, neither of them had a bachelor's degree, you know, a college degree, but they're smart people. But you know, they certainly weren't teaching me a deep love of science when I was growing up. And so what I got was what I got from the church educational system, which was basically anti-science sort of mentality. So I experienced the kind of disillusionment you're talking about, trying to reconcile all this, because I had read, I did come from sort of a fundamentalist point of view. But what I'm hearing you say is that if you're taught a non-fundamentalist view from the early years, and if you are taught to love and respect science, and if you are taught a more nuanced, sophisticated, or we'll just say a different religious perspective, then you can face science in your teen and adult years without really any serious crises of faith necessarily, and you can mature into adulthood with a very harmonious relationship between science and religion. Is that what you're saying?
I would even be stronger than that. I would say that someone that has a good foundation, that respect and reverence for the natural world and for the scientific laws that we study can be a foundation for religious faith for the rest of your life. It certainly is for me, and it's the real core of my religious beliefs. Like I mentioned at the beginning, Albert Einstein, and talking about how that this cosmic religious feeling was really the foundation of all great science, and all great religion. And I think that is what it can be, and that is what I would like to see be more common, for other people to feel that that same passion that those of us in the scientific world feel.
So you just said that for you, science becomes faith-affirming and faith-strengthening for you.
Oh, very much.
Yeah, and there I have so many friends right now, and a lot of this comes from disillusionment with church history, but they first become disillusioned with church history, then they realize that science isn't the enemy, then they start reading Hitchens and Dawkins, then they sort of, you know, for them, a love for science necessarily means a dropping of not only Mormonism, but of any belief in God or religion at all. And so let me ask you to spend some time on this question. How, let's say that I'm raising several young kids right now. What are some of the critical steps, and I'm happy taking 15 minutes on this question or 20, what are some of the steps that I need to take to raise a child to, number one, appreciate science? But I think that I can take care of that. You know, let them read scientific books, take them to museums, let them watch good, you know, science TV shows. But more importantly, how do I need to raise them from a religious and spiritual standpoint as children and teens, such that science becomes something that strengthens their faith versus weakens it? What are some of the fundamental things that I need to teach my children, or ways to raise them in a Mormon and in a religious environment?
Well, for starters, I just think that they need to understand at an early age that the different realms of science and religion. This well-known biologist, Stephen Jay Gould, he wrote this book on science and religion, and he pointed out, his central concept was this idea of non-overlapping magisteria, of how that science and the scientific method is the best tools that we have for understanding the natural world and how it evolves and changes and what are the laws that undergird it. And that whereas religion is a realm of how we understand really get a grip on what is really the meaning of life, and what are the moral principles that we should abide by, and how we should form values for our life. And there really is no need for those two realms to conflict. And again, that's perhaps a little bit simplistic. There are going to be a lot of times when we're going to wonder, well, which side of that divide are we on? But I think in general, that's a good principle. You know, like I wrote in a comment that was actually published in the Salt Lake Tribune about 4 or 5 years ago, when they were discussing this issue of intelligent design. And I just said, leave science to science. If we have questions that are of a scientific nature, then let's leave those to the field of scientific research, which actually is the same thing that was said by the first presidency back in 1931, and which is also part of this the current statement that's in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism on evolution. And so we first get that principle over, and then we go out, as you say, go out to science museums, and then just go out into nature. I mean, I remember about 2 or 3 years ago, I went with my my wife, I think in May, we went to a trip to Yosemite Valley, and we hiked partway up the trail that leads to the top of Half Dome. And along the way, there are a couple just gorgeous waterfalls. And in fact, as it turned out, the very day that we were there was the highest flow of water coming over the waterfalls of not only that entire year, but for several years since. And so it was really a pretty spectacular sight. I took several pictures. But I remember... I still remember just being so overwhelmed with the beauty of that spot and the beauty of the waterfalls and all of the varied nature around there that I was just bawling as I headed back down the trail. And I think that and some other times when I've been out hiking or out camping in the woods, I've had those sorts of experiences. Those are the sorts of experiences I think that can really seal a long time love of science and love of nature. And that's what I would really suggest, is that as parents, that we try to convey those same types of experiences to the youth.
Okay. The couple things I've heard so far is try and frame for your children what religion's place is and what science place is within their lives, respectively, that they don't have to be conflicting. And then foster for them generally a basic love of science, including lots of time in nature. When it comes to religion and science and their respective roles, you would agree that it's fair to say that sometimes religion overreaches and makes pronouncements or statements that it probably is best not making. Would you say that's fair?
Oh, yes, and that's a source of a great deal of a conflict. Is just like when the Catholic Church felt that it would rule in the case of Galileo. You know, in retrospect, this was really pretty foolish. You know, why did the church feel that it wanted to be an authority on a purely scientific question? And more recently, with the many who feel that the scriptures should be read as a scientific textbook and should tell us very precise technical details, say, about the timeline of the creation. You know, clearly that's overstepping the proper bounds. But I think we also have to say that people like Hitchens and Dawkins
have
overstepped their bounds.
That's right.
There is this underlying presumption that they have is that religion is bunk and is something of no content. That is certainly not a belief that they can defend by the process of empirical science. That's a religious belief just as every bit as much as those of the fundamentalists.
Right.
And there are several books that have commented on this in great detail. There's no need for me to rehearse all of that. But what struck me is that not only theologians have seen the flaw that Hitchens and Dawkins are making, but even some scientists who are basically at least agnostic on their own. Still, clearly, expressed concern that the Hitchens and Dawkins were stepping out of their bounds, not only just because it was unwise to do so and creating a public relations problem for science, but also because their arguments really didn't hold water. In particular, there was metaphysical assumptions underlying their comments that were every bit as much outside the realm of science as religious beliefs are.
Right, right. And so I'm not only hearing you say that that Hitchens and Dawkins and others maybe have done science a disservice in terms of the traction that it might have in mainstream America. But I would ask you, would you say that they don't represent the dispositions of the average scientist that you encounter with regards to religion?
Absolutely, they do not.
So they are
definitely a minority view
among scientists.
Yes.
And what would you say? Could you give a estimate pie chart of like percentage of scientists? This is all anecdotal, but I mean, just as a general sense, you deal with scientists every day in your field. Would you say that there are lots of religious scientists, faithful scientists, believing scientists? Would you say that that's the anomaly, that that's normal? How would you frame the distribution of belief among scientists in your anecdotal experience?
I think we have to distinguish between traditional belief and denominational membership and a more fundamental belief that's something along the line of what Einstein was discussing. In fact, Einstein is sort of a good example because he was raised in a Jewish family, of course, but he struggled with some of these issues when he was young, but he basically, beginning at some point, had rejected what we would normally consider to be orthodox personal God religion. But nonetheless, he, as I mentioned, had this very strong reverence for the natural laws, the beauty of these laws of the universe. And he wrote more than once about this cosmic religious feeling. And so as I look at the scientists around me, I would say in a lot of ways that's mirrored. Relatively few of them would be described as active, wearing publicly on their label that they are active, participating members of some denomination. And this perhaps is what leads the general public perception that scientists aren't religious.
Right.
But if we then go to this other category of someone who is not really allied with any particular denomination, but nonetheless deeply religious in a very fundamental way, then I would say yes. I would say probably 70-80% are in that category.
So
there are who have some very fundamental reverence for that, that perhaps they can't quite define clearly what in classical traditional religious terms, but nonetheless are very much fascinated by religion, or very much have a very deep reverence for the natural world, and that are very much concerned with ethics and morality. I mean, for instance, I would, from everything I have seen, professional scientists are a very moral group. Like this was driven home to me a while back when there was a case there at the Berkeley lab of scientific fraud. In fact, a couple cases. In one case, there's this scientist had published some data that was suggesting that overhead power lines were leading to increases in cancer. And it was later found that her data was just, you know, really not just wishful thinking, but had really been fudged to forge her conclusions. And when this came out, the action of the lab management was very quick. She was terminated from her position, and letters of apology were sent to the various journals in which she had published. And so even what I'm saying is, even though there was no question of whether or not it was a politically correct conclusion of her papers, simply the fact that she had been less than fully honest in the way she had dealt with her data was considered a very serious breach of ethics.
Right. And I have to, on the part of my listeners, I can hear some of them frustrated with the, you know, equating of morality and ethics with religious belief, because in my experience and you know what I'm often reminded of is that there can be you know the examples of very moral and ethical atheists are legion, and so I totally concede that science has very high standards of ethics generally, and that's well embedded within the culture. But am I also hearing you say that many of these scientists, though they may not affiliate with a specific religious denomination, in addition to being ethical and moral, might not self-identify as an atheist and or would espouse some significant spiritual component of belief to their worldview?
Oh, very much so.
Okay.
In fact,
okay.
I would say that furthermore, that's true of even some that wear the label atheist, because I think what they say they really mean by atheist is that they really cannot accept traditional or the creeds of traditional religious denominations. But nonetheless, they have a very deeply spiritual life in a way that perhaps is hard to define.
Okay. Okay, cool. So we were talking about ways to raise an LDS child such that they don't encounter this crisis of faith. And so we've talked about segmenting the role of religion and science, and even though sometimes they attempt to bleed into the other realms, it's our job to help try and establish some clear lines between them. We've talked about how we can build a reverence for science. How do we teach our children to approach scripture, their reading of scripture, and their views on prophetic utterances and other utterances from church leadership and from ecclesiastical authority?
Well, I think it helps to emphasize some of the positive parts of the scriptures. I think it helps to like even in the creation scriptures, why can't we emphasize ways in which the teachings of the Garden of Eden and the creation can really be a positive force in our life? Like I remember once that earlier in my career that it sort of became clear that the current path that I was on and the sort of the work that I was doing was just not something that I could sustain, that I could continue, that there were other parts of my life, including my family, that were sort of steering me in a different direction. And I remember I really struggled with this for a while. And that to me, that this work that I was doing was sort of like the Garden of Eden. It was really paradise. But then I remember I actually was reading in the scriptures once, reading the passage about the Garden of Eden and the fall and the expulsion, and it suddenly occurred to me that this was something that really applied to me, and that, you know, sometimes we have to leave the Garden of Eden. And that in the long run, we'll probably be better off. And I would say, looking back on my career, that was the career decision I made at the time was the right one. And I have a much broader view of science. I think much more broadly successful in my career as a result of making that change, as unpleasant as it was at the time. I think there are lessons like that we can emphasize, that, and that's really looking at the scriptures the right way. It's drawing the right lessons out of them, and not dwelling on these conflicts that we often get so obsessed with. Even like I think there's some very profound thoughts, like in some other parts of, say, of the Old Testament, in particular, the book of Job. I think that actually most LDS people don't really get the book of Job. I mean, I think the book of Job is just one of the most profound analyses that's ever been done on the problem of suffering and what's the meaning of God, and what the answer was that Job finally got out of that. Many LDS people just sort of breeze through Job and read a few missionary scriptures here and there, but otherwise don't really understand what it was all about. The book of Ecclesiastes is another one of my favorites. It's a rather frank. I mean, it's very clear that the person who wrote Ecclesiastes was a very liberal-minded person. And he goes and he talks about a lot of these different areas that have led to problems. But then in the end, what does he conclude? He says, there's one verse that just says, do what's right, that this is the whole duty of man. Hmm. And so I think that this is something that we can all learn from, that we can discuss theology and we can discuss science and religion for that matter till we're blue in the face. But in the end, is what kind of a life that we lead is really the most important. And I think if we can focus more on these positive messages, then I think it will be easier for the youth to see how some of these other, you know, passages that cause problems are really the exception and not the rule.
So, am I hearing you say that with our children, we should teach them to bring a healthy dose of looking at the scriptures metaphorically, of looking at them symbolically, of looking at how they're almost mythical, in how they can apply, to our lives, and sometimes not only discourage, you know, focusing on controversy, but make them feel fully liberated and empowered to view the scriptures figuratively, or as even incorrect, when they feel like they conflict with reason or with science?
Yeah, I think there is some of that. I think what you're saying is exactly correct. But from what I can see, though, that exact message is taught in some places in the discourses of the church. And in other words, we can really see some support for doing it. One of the most interesting passages I like to quote for some people is actually a comment made by Joseph Fielding Smith, of all people, where he just goes on very it's in that quotation page of mine on my website, where he just goes and very emphatically says that how important it is that in the scriptures that we read, that we recognize a figure of speech and a metaphor and a parable in its proper setting, and that we not try to read all of that literal. In fact, he even says that the notion that we should read all of these things literally is a stupid thought.
Who is this again that says this?
This is Joseph Fielding Smith.
Okay.
Go. It's you can look for it on that quotation page. It's a great. I don't have it right in front of me, or I'd read it to you.
Well, that's fine.
But the point is, it's not too hard to find support for that type of approach to the scriptures, and even within the writings of the general authorities. And I think once youth feel the freedom that they can view the scriptures that way, and that way view them in a positive light, then I think that's very helpful.
So what you probably get less of, and that's great to know. I think a lot of people will be refreshed to hear that. Even, you know, Joseph Fielding Smith or Brigham Young would encourage people to bring a healthy dose of non-literalism and metaphorical, you know, value and interpretation to the scriptures. So that's all wonderful, and I do hope that our listeners will check out some of those quotes. And I also think your point about how, you know, Joseph Smith clearly didn't have a lot of affection for the perfection of the Bible, and clearly felt like the Bible had lots of room for improvement, sort of shows that sort of begins at the very earliest of our church experience, right?
Oh, I would say that Mormonism was founded on the premise that the Bible is not perfect.
Right,
and that the end is not complete, or you might say Mormonism was founded on the premise on a rejection of biblical inerrancy.
Okay, but what you probably find less of, and maybe I'm wrong, especially today, are modern day prophets, seers, and revelators telling us that we're free to discount or dismiss their urgencies or their utterances as, you know, metaphorical or symbolic or as, you know, not necessarily needed to be obeyed. And so, you know, does it get a little bit touchier or difficult when it, you know, because, you know, for example, Bruce Haven stands up in front of Affirmation and affirmatively declares as a general authority that homosexuality is not in your DNA. He does this in 2009. You know, that was alarming to a lot of people and problematic, but a lot of other people just said, okay, well, if that's what a general authority says, that's what we need to believe. You know, I don't hear a lot of encouragement from general authorities saying you can take our utterances as metaphorical or symbolic if you feel like they are not in conflict with reason or science. Although I know that in the past you could find statements from Hubie Brown or even Joseph Smith of Brigham Young saying, I'm only a prophet when I'm speaking as a prophet. But, you know, that's a little bit harder to tease out, isn't it?
Yes, I think that that this issue of when one of the leaders of the church teaches something that we disagree with, this is obviously a difficult matter. This has always been a problem within Mormondom. I think on one hand, I think that liberal-minded people do need to be more circumspect about correctly representing what is being taught and not trying to mislead those that we're talking to into what has been said. But in general, there's no easy answer here. What I think is important, what I would like to see eventually a little bit more freedom is to, in LDS scholarly discourse, is to be able to say, yes, this leader taught this, this leader taught that. My personal opinion is this, which I recognize disagrees with that. And to, in other words, respectfully disagree and then not have this be something that you're liable to be punished for or something like that.
And you're saying that in the past that's been the case, or that there's been fears that that's the case, or there's just been a cultural reticence, or do you think that's come from the leadership? I mean, how do you parse that out? Or do you just would you want to avoid that?
I would say everything you said is correct. But you see, what I'm saying, I think it's just as wrong to selectively teach only from the general authorities that we like,
right?
And not mention those that by those who we disagree with. I would really like to see the time come when it's even in Sunday school, say that it's if it's handled respectfully and reasonably well to say yes, this LDS leader has taught this, this other LDS leader has taught that. My personal view is this, which may not coincide with what has been taught. Or at least to be honest in expressing some disagreement without fear that your church membership is going to be on the line.
Right, right. Okay.
But I do think it's important that we be respectful and that we not go over bounds and being very critical and nasty when we're discussing the leadership of the church any more than it would be appropriate if we were talking about some of the writings of colleagues in scientific or scholarly research that we're doing. You know, there's really no place in the scholarly world for intemperate or inconsiderate comments.
It's so true. I'm working on a master's thesis where we're trying to advance a specific treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder that we think is far superior to the current gold standard treatment. And I've tried to write, you know, a couple paragraphs just basically saying why we think the current gold standard treatment is inadequate and why we think that our treatment's better. And my advisor is strongly discouraging me from using any of that type of language, because there's just this courtesy in scientific discourse that just tries to avoid nastiness and you know, negativity, which I might not have ever assumed about science before I actually joined the field. Has that been your experience as well?
That's very much the case, because science is all about collaboration. I mean, yeah. You know, you say something kind of nasty about some colleague, well, maybe you'll be on the same project with them 2 years from now, or
right.
Maybe there'll be an opportunity to write a joint proposal for some government funding, or you might even want to, at some point, writing a joint article or study. And so people that make discourteous comments, that invariably comes around to hurt them. And I don't see any reason that we can't apply the same principle to our discussions of church leaders, even historical figures, as we have this evening. There's, you know, certainly there's no reason that we can't do this courteously.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.